And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello, and welcome back to Millennial 2025. And I'm now here with a regular face, or regular avatar at any rate, Endeavor. Endeavor, welcome back to Millennial.
Thanks for having me on again. It's always a pleasure every year.
Excellent. I think this has been a very good year for us, for our cause. And from what we were saying before we went on air, it sounds like you basically agree with that. Why don't you start us off with your own bird's eye summary of 2025, general thoughts about it?
Okay, so my general thoughts on 2025 are overall, it was a good year. Things have gone in the right direction. Now, I have a lot of negatives that I want to get into a bit later, but I will say that the positive overall is that our ideas are now being discussed at a much higher level and by a much broader audience. So the fact that words like remigration are now being tweeted out by people like Elon Musk, the fact that mainstream political parties are now discussing the issue of remigration. I mean, this was something which it was just relegated to our scene 7 or 8 years ago, even 3-4 years ago. But the fact that this is now being discussed in mainstream society, I don't think the elites are going to implement it tomorrow. But now that it's actually kind of entered the discussion, and then the idea as well that, you know, do we have a legitimate claim to our countries? The fact that these ideas are being discussed now is undeniably a positive. So what I wanted to say to start is that at the beginning of this year, I wrote a series of essays and turned them into a video, and I titled it America's Thermidorian Reaction. And I think that I'm pretty happy with how that prediction kind of panned out. And I don't think it's just America. I also think that it's applicable to the broader Western world. You can see this in countries like the UK or Canada as well. Now, what was the Thermidorian reaction? So it's from the French Revolution. I'm sure everyone here knows the story of the Reign of Terror. So after the Jacobins took over France and they had the Committee of Public Safety, the king had been decapitated. They were decapitating all the enemies of the revolution. France was controlled by the Committee of Public Safety with Robespierre at the helm. And France went through a several months long period where people were just being guillotined daily. It was the most radical phase of the French Revolution. And what the Thermidorian reaction was, it was when other revolutionaries who were not quite as radical as Robespierre, I mean, some of them had even taken part in the Reign of Terror, but they realized that, well, if things go on like this, eventually it's going to be my neck on the chopping block. And they overthrew Robespierre and then kind of moderated the French revolutionary regime to a degree. So from about 1794 to 1799, before Napoleon took over, France was ruled by a revolutionary regime, but a more moderate one. So they still maintained the ideals of the revolution, but they weren't guillotining thousands and thousands of people. So like it was legal to be a monarchist in France again. It wasn't just instant death. And I kind of feel that the Trump 2.0 and what you've seen in some other countries is kind of like that. So I don't think that someone like Trump, well, I don't think he's a very ideological figure at all. I don't think that he's like genuinely against the post-war consensus. I think he's too old to be against it because, you know, he's pushing 80 now. And I don't feel like the Trump administration are genuinely against it in many ways. But I mean, it's caused the wokeism of the Great Awakening, that being 2014 to, let's say, 2024. Rough estimates, second Obama administration through the first Trump, through the Biden. This was the time of the transgenderism, the so-called refugee crisis, the open borders in the U.S.-Mexico border with all the floods across the Mediterranean and Europe, things with like BLM and the pandemic and all the craziness I'm sure everybody is really familiar with. I kind of liken that to the reign of terror of during the French Revolution. And what we've seen is kind of a calming down of that. There hasn't been this overthrow of the kind of globalist neoliberal elites under the post-war narrative, but they've kind of moderated that to an extent, which I think that there are positives and negatives of that. One is that I think people shouldn't like plan a parade route or anything because there's still a lot more work to do. We haven't achieved remigration yet. We haven't taken back our countries. However, I think that it signifies the kind of the process that we've seen playing out over the past 10 years, but maybe even just the post-war consensus in general, really running out of steam. Like there's nowhere to go with it. No one says diversity is our strength with enthusiasm anymore. No one's excited about more multiculturalism. So there hasn't been this reversal of it, but it's kind of run out of steam and it's been moderated a bit. And what this has done is it's actually opened the door for our ideas to get into the discussion a lot more. So that's kind of my overall, that was my feeling at the beginning of this year. And I'm overall happy with that assessment.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate. It's definitely seems like the way things are now. I don't know. I think that Trump 2.0, it started with a lot of momentum and a sort of aggression. And I think a lot of people were very optimistic about it for that reason. And a lot of cold water was poured on that last millennial by Blackpilled and several others. And I think they did turn out to be broadly correct, because after all, in September, Charlie Kirk was killed. And the Trump administration so far, it's been 3 months now, and the Trump administration has not gone hard against the left. They haven't used that momentum. They haven't used that event to really go after the left and destroy it. They talk, and they're still talking about doing that, going after Antifa, dismantling Antifa. But not much seems to be actually happening. So it seems rather that the Trump 2.0 symbolizes the end of wokery as a social crusade, if not as an ongoing social fact. I think a lot of the stuff is still going on. A lot of the policies are still in place, and the people who put them in place are still in position. So what would you say about this concept that Academic Agent put about, that the woke is being put away? I've always been skeptical of that. I've always thought it's true and it's not true at the same time. What would you say about this? The woke is being put away.
Well, I think that I agree with it to an extent. I don't know if I agree entirely with Academic Agent's assessment of it. What I feel is that in some ways it's been put away just because it had to be put away. So, for example, you look at some of these corporations and they just had absolutely ludicrous policies with this DEI program. And then what they end up with is just a bunch of people in their company who are totally incompetent. There was this great article written, I think it was in either 2023, I believe. It was titled that complex systems won't survive the competence crisis. And it was written by a guy, I think his name was Harold Robertson. And he went through how in this case, the United States, how the infrastructure of the United States was pretty much eroding because of these policies, which had been in place for decades, but, you know, were turned up to 11 in the past 10 years. This being what we would call today DEI or diversity hiring, this idea or affirmative action, which, as we all know, it's a lot older than it predates the Great Awakening. This goes back to the 60s and 70s. But what he talked about is how like it's eroding the competence of American society. And this can be broadly applied to other countries as well. When you place a goal above, when you make an institution's goal something other than its express purpose, it's not going to be as competent. So, for example, if you're a fire department What's your goal? Your goal is to put out fires. But if you make diversity your goal, well, then you're going to be less effective at putting out fires. And we saw plenty of examples of this. If you remember, at the end of last year, there were those hurricanes in, I think it was the Carolinas. And what you saw was that FEMA had all of these DEI policies in place and their response was ineffective. And I mean, this was happening across the board. It still is happening, but there was a genuine part where a lot of people, they might not have been ideologically identitarian or nationalistic or anything, but they're just looking at this and thinking, well, this is going to be a disaster for my bottom line. A corporation could look at it like that. Like Boeing, for example, the people designing jet airplanes, they had this ridiculous DEI policy in place. And well, I mean, again, going back to what is the goal of Boeing? The goal should be to design effective aircrafts which don't crash. But if they're making the goal diversity and that they're prioritizing diversity over building effective aircrafts, well, the aircrafts are going to be a lot less safe and you're going to have disasters. So I think that part of the woke, the woke being put away, so to say, I think part of that is just out of necessity that it's just begetting all of this incompetence. And a lot of people are worried about how in the elite class are worried about the implications of that. Another thing is that it's kind of just run out of the cultural momentum it had behind it. So you look at back at something like, you look back at the 2010s. I remember in the first couple of years of Trudeau in Canada, like all of that. I mean, Trudeau today, he was a laughing stock when he left office at the beginning of this year. But when he came into office, he was like this golden boy. He was seen as this modern, progressive.
He was cool. He was cool. I mean, it's like actually thought of flared trousers were probably thought of as cool in 1970, but by 1980, it was you were a clown if you were, and it's, I don't mean to trivialize, I'm just saying this is how something passes from cool to cringe.
Yeah, and I feel like that's what's happened with woke in many ways, is that people are sick of, a lot of people are sick of just the shrill, moralistic, unpleasant cultural environment that it's created. And then just the other thing is the reality that it just hasn't made society better. Life is significantly worse in the West than it was, even just 10 years ago. And these, woke social policies have not only not prevented that, they've actively facilitated, the worsening of quality of life in the West. So I feel like this is what I would say is the woke being put away. But I don't want to go too far with that because I feel like it's still kind of there. Like one thing I noticed in Canada this year is that in my hometown Toronto, I mean, they still have woke stuff everywhere. They still have LGBT stuff. They still have Black History Month stuff, which is supposed to be February, but they had it up in June or July, and they still have all of, you turn on CBC radio, it's still stuff about refugees and about sexism in the workplace, and it's still all that like 2016 era stuff. But then like they're also now trying to like reinstill some kind of patriotism. So Mark Carney's Liberal government has kind of like in response to Trump and the whole tariff war and all of that that saga, they've tried to like say, well, we're the party of patriotism again, even though that same party had spent the last 10 years saying that Canada is a post-national country and that we're responsible, that we should feel ashamed for genocide and that we're horrible people. So I feel like the narrative is just one that's a lot more confused now. It's like we don't have one. So, I mean, we still have the woke people around. We still have the LGBT stuff here and there. I mean, it doesn't really have like the stranglehold on the culture that it had a couple of years ago. And now we kind of have this faux civic patriotism. You know, you see that in the Carney government, you see that kind of with the Trump, but even that's not exactly really taking off either. It's just like we have no dominant narrative now, I find.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's interesting how this is still around, but it doesn't have the cachet that it had 3 or 4 years ago. I think one factor that you didn't mention that probably is relevant is just that the transgender thing has become discredited in a big way. Not completely yet, but it's happening, and it has been happening for a two or three years now, I guess, since about 2023, there was some report, I can't remember the name of it, but it was published, I think in Britain, which began this this change of mood towards that issue and towards the puberty blockers for kids and so forth. And I think that was actually a serious blow to wokery in general, because trans was really the most extreme and, you could say, the most central part of wokery. It was the greatest demand that it made of ordinary people, that you no longer, that you relinquish your belief in male and female. I mean, that is a very radical thing to ask of people.
I'm from Toronto, which is arguably the most libtarded, crazy, progressive, leftist city in the Western world. And I had never even heard of transgenderism until 2015, 2016. I mean, I might have seen like some movie about like a joke about a man becoming a woman or something like that. But like all of that transgender stuff, I had like it was new to me back like about a decade ago. And then it just all of a sudden was made the social issue of our time. And I mean, one thing is it's just bizarre, but also it's just hellish to imagine because, like you mentioned, just thinking of what that actually entails. First of all, the nightmarish medical procedures that are involved in that, and the implications that has on somebody's life, and then that it demands that you rethink male and female, which has been the human norm for all of. For all of human history, and not even all of human history, all of biological mammalian history, mammalian history. Yeah. But we're just supposed to like pretend that that's not the case now because some like SJW with purple hair said that that you're a bigot if you don't think it, if you believe that. And it never took off. I mean, I maybe met like one transgender person, maybe two. Like, I mean, I don't really remember very many of them. Like it did not take off. Nobody ever started using these Z-Zer pronouns or anything like that. And, the left invested so much into this transgenderism and just with the aggression as well, just how aggressive they were, which what we can get into later with the whole Charlie Kirk thing. But, yeah, and eventually it ran out of steam because you know they put everything they had into it, and it, like even Scott Howard wrote a book called The Transgender Industrial Complex, which just goes down all of the insane programs and medical procedures and propaganda that has gone into pushing this stuff. But yeah, it has really kind of gone out of fashion. And well, I mean, I did write something about this year, which is kind of related to another thing that we might get onto. But when you imagine that somebody quite literally gave their body for this social trend, now this is already a highly neurotic person, and then they quite literally sacrificed their body for temporarily elevated social status. And kind of this ability to, I mean, I also find that like there's this sadism that a lot of the transgenderism thing had, that they derive this pleasure from forcing people to think of a man in a dress as a woman. Like there's this Yaniv man in British Columbia who wanted to be a woman.
Oh yes.
It was basically his thing that he'd go around tormenting people like this and then filing human rights complaints when somebody didn't go along with it.
Wax my balls,
right? Yeah, that was it. I mean, it's crazy that such a thing was ever even entertained. But when you think of the people who have gone all in on this thing, like, and then furthermore, this stuff was pushed on kids. They had things like they had puberty blockers. This is prepubescent children that this was pushed on,
and telling little children. That, well, you might well be a boy or if you've got this. That used to be, and this was what was always so amazing about the trans stuff. It used to be a given that kids are very, very impressionable and they will believe what you tell them, pretty much whatever you tell them, as long as you are serious and insistent enough about it. And B, kids have all sorts of random ideas themselves. And it was an understanding that It's the job of adults not to affirm crazy stuff that kids say about them, about the world, or about themselves. And so the trans thing demanded that you do the opposite. And when your kid says, I'm a girl or whatever, you actually affirm it. And indeed, that if a parent didn't do that, then they could lose their child, because they're then an abuser. So it was profoundly immoral and sick and cruel.
Well, I just want to add that, like, on top of everything I've said, like, this is another thing that just made this thing lose its lose its cultural force behind it, was that it was pushed on kids. Like, I mean, honestly, I still find this stuff hellish when it's even just adults, but it was quite explicitly pushed at children.
It very much was. And this always amazed me, the drag kids and the drag queen story hour. Why is it going to be a drag queen? Why can't the story hour be some little old lady who lives near to the school? Why is it going to be a fucking drag queen? It's absolutely outrageous. And it was very specifically targeting and openly targeting kids again and again and again and again. And this is why it astounds me that this was able to, that this happened and that it was able to go on for so long. I mean, when you've got like some 8-year-old boy prancing about at a gay pride march in drag or barely clad at all, how on earth can that be okay? Of course, it's always these middle-class mothers who go along with it and take their kid to drag queen story hour. I don't want to go into a, like, 2021 rant here, but right. It's even in retrospect, it's astonishing.
Well, yeah, I mean, and this ties into something else that I said, that it feels like the left has lost a lot of the moral legitimacy that it had behind it, say in 2020 with the George Floyd fiasco, with the worldwide riots and demonstrations kneeling down for George Floyd. The left is sorry.
Well, I was hoping to delay getting to that, but I think that what we've just been talking about sort of builds towards that. It is one component of that. So you go on now.
Well, yeah. So I think that one thing that we're seeing is kind of this loss of moral legitimacy of the left, of the anti-fascist left, or the post-war liberal progressive left. So I mean, there are many facets of this. So one of them is what we've been talking about, that I think most people do find that the transgenderism thing just hellish. I've met very liberal people who say that they actually find it quite disturbing. And this is people who, you know, 10 years ago were all on board the whole LGBT thing. But there's that, and there's also there's also the fact that the left has just been totally totally either ignored or made excuses for one outrage after another, like Rotherham. And we're going quite a ways back now with something like Bataclan, and then all these different attacks and crimes, whether it's something like the Irina Zarutsin murder, or just like a random attack like that, or, you know, some more planned out terrorist attack. And the left has just been playing defense for this for years and years at this point. Now, I mean, this is one thing that really kind of woke me up back in 2015, is just how apologetic they were for Muslims after the Bataclan attack. They should have lost the moral legitimacy back then, but it still did take some time. Just the fact that they've just constantly had to go to bat to defend one atrocity after another and kind of downplay it, I think that's another aspect. And then there's the Charlie Kirk assassination. Now, there are two aspects of this. I mean, the one we'll get into first is what it really meant for the left, what it meant for their moral legitimacy, and then, you know, as we're talking about the transgender issue, then I can get on to like how I feel that the right kind of how the right kind of botched that opportunity. But I guess I'll get on to first is that I feel like the murder of Charlie Kirk it was the biggest blow to the anti-fascist left's moral legitimacy, possibly since the Second World War, certainly that I can ever remember, because not only the fact that it was a 31-year-old father of two brutally murdered on a live stream in front of a crowd of a bunch of college students, in front of his own family. And not only that, the fact that that happened, but then that a non-significant portion of leftists and liberals came out and actually in some ways celebrated the fact that he had been murdered. I mean, I don't mean to cherry pick. Of course, there have been far right terrorists. There has been far right violence, but there's never been this case where the right has come out and then actively cheered on some psychopath who goes and murders a bunch of people.
It was thousands of leftists, and they were absolutely celebrating it. They were joyful about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, Destiny went on. It was Piers Morgan, I think. And I mean, we can get to him later, but he went on Piers Morgan and said that this is what you get for voting for Trump. If you don't want this to happen, you shouldn't have voted for Trump. Basically saying that that the murder was he's basically saying that it's justified. I feel like that's kind of one part that they crossed the line. Now, I will get onto a bit later how I feel like the right kind of botched that opportunity. But just to focus on this aspect of it alone, I do feel like this did it did change things in that. Well, what we saw is that some leftists got canceled. People who are openly celebrating a murder lost their positions of power, which is a good thing, because for the decade prior, and even before that, actually, it was always right wingers who were canceled for much less egregious infractions. It was like if you tweeted out, "It's okay to be white," or you made a joke about Obama back in 2008 or 2009 that everyone had forgotten about on Twitter, that you'd be fired from your job. Or like Papa John, Papa John, the CEO of Papa John's Pizza was canceled for saying I don't know what you can say on the stream. Let's just say the N word, since I know you're in Britain and everything. And
yeah.
He said that, like, but out of context. He just said, like, you know, in the past, people used to say that this, and just with no context at all, he was fired from the massive corporation he had spent his life building. He was removed as the CEO, that was the climate we were in back in 2019, 2018 or so. But there's been a bit of a reversal there now. Like, you kind of, on the right, you kind of can get away with a bit more now. You know, if you're in some libtard university, you can't get away with it. If you're working for one of these big corporations, might not be a good idea to come out as one of our guys in the boardroom. But that kind of pressure has been kind of taken off of the right, possibly because the left just cried wolf too much. That they were saying, like, everyone's a Nazi. Papa John is a Nazi. But now you kind of see that happening to the left. And I'll be honest, though, I think that it's a lot. I, first of all, I don't feel bad about leftists losing positions of power, because ultimately to have change, you have to remove them. But secondly, they're celebrating a murder which took place at a school. And I mean, if that's not something that's just antisocial and you don't want that person to have any influence over any kind of school, corporation, media outlet, I mean, that's got to be it.
Oh, absolutely. I should say, as far as I know, Charlie Kirk's kids weren't there when it happened. They didn't see it happening.
Okay, maybe
I don't know. Yeah, everyone thought that at the time. And I actually, when I wrote an essay about this, I put that in. And then I was told that's not true. It's been that they weren't present. But it doesn't really... It doesn't change much. I just want to be accurate. The reaction from leftists was hideous, and I think it was so interesting because it showed how cosseted they had been up until that point. And I think they had no idea that they were endangering their employment, their reputations, etc., by doing this. And I think it came as a huge shock to them when at least some of them suffered for doing this. I think they thought that they had immunity. while simultaneously believing that they were oppressed, which they always somehow managed to believe. Nonetheless, despite believing themselves oppressed, supposedly, they also believed that they would suffer no consequences for mocking a man's brutal death. And when it did happen, they were shocked. And I think I wish that the right had gone further and in reaction to that and got more of them fired. I wish more of them had suffered because look what they've imposed on us over the last 15 years. Revenge could have been sweeter, let's say.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that the fact that they would actually just go out and openly celebrate a murder, like one example was that there was a teacher in Toronto who said to a classroom of 10 and 11 year olds that the murder was justified, pretty much. That's a teacher justifying a school shooting, a murder that took place at a school. And I mean, it's just like what kind of it's incredible when you think of it, but how do they get into this kind of mindset? It's because they had that level of momentum and of moral weight behind them for so long. And I do feel like that's kind of cracking. And I feel like something like Charlie Kirk's murder was a bit of a crack in that I don't feel like coming out and saying like open borders, refugees welcome, no one is illegal on stolen land. I don't feel like this gives you the social status that it gave you a couple of years ago. Let's look like, say, back in 2015 when there was the so-called migrant crisis, and every politician, every media person was just out there desperate to show how open their hearts were to Ahmed from Syria or whatever it is. I feel like that has kind of lost a lot of the social prestige which it had a couple of years ago, and that's why, you know, a lot of these leftists were in for a rude awakening when they ended up actually suffering consequences for their actions. Now, one thing you mentioned is that it's that you wish that the right had gained more ground off of this. Now, here's another thing. Now, I mean, a lot of the things that we've been talking about so far have been the positives of the past year, but I think that one of the major failings was not gaining enough ground off of Charlie Kirk's murder. Now, I know that Trump couldn't go out and arrest every single person with left-leaning views in the United States. But honestly, I think that both the mainstream right and kind of the online, what used to be called the dissident right, but it's not really that, it's not really that dissident anymore, but they both dropped the ball in very different ways. The first problem, I think, was that the mainstream right, this being the GOP, Donald Trump, they did do a few good things. They did list Antifa as a terrorist organization. That's a positive. They did list several foreign Antifa groups as terrorist groups. But beyond that, they kind of just used the murder of Charlie Kirk as an opportunity to go on, to do a campaign rally and to just turn it into this kind of, evangelical mega church big spectacle where they sell Pokemon cards and
that was grotesque.
I felt bad for the guy. Like that funeral was a joke. They have fireworks going off at and they announce Erica Kirk coming onto stage like some WWE wrestling fight or something like that.
And to be accurate, it wasn't at the funeral. That was a memorial service. The funeral, as far as I know, I hope I'm right in saying this, the funeral was a completely separate and much more private event. That thing that everyone saw was a memorial service, but it doesn't actually change anything. I mean, it was totally tasteless and vulgar.
I mean, so this is the first aspect of this is that this ties in with a concept which I guess I might have been the one to coin this word. I don't know if I was or not, but people have adopted it since then. It's what I call slopulism. So it's slop and populism. And the way that I define slopulism is that it's pretty much a kind of right-leaning politics as an entertainment product. So, and this, I think you mentioned that at the beginning, that the Trump administration kind of kicked off with a lot of aggression and a lot of the optimism. And I kind of find that this was kind of what you saw in the first couple months of the Trump admin. I wrote an article about this in the spring this year, about the phenomenon of slopulism. So with populism, it's giving a voice to the discontent of the masses against the ruling class. And I mean, the appeal of something like populism is that your long held grievances, that being things like mass immigration or inflation or job loss or housing costs, what have you, that finally being addressed. But the other appeal of populism is that it gives you kind of this feeling of rebellion, that you're fighting back against the elite class who you probably very rightly have anger against. But what I would say what I would call slopulism is where those concrete issues are neglected for the spectacle, for that kind of emotional high, which being like anti-system or being against the Eurocrats or against the Democrats or whatever, or the World Economic Forum. It's like that. It's that kind of emotional high that sense of rebellion gives you, replacing the actual concrete issues. And you saw that with something like the Charlie Kirk murder, because the GOP just turned it into this big spectacle where they're like making Charlie Kirk commemorative coins. And I felt really embarrassed by that. It's becoming this big problem on the right, because so much of X and so much of the social media sphere is kind of just becoming entertainment. One example of just how damaging what I call slopulism actually is, we now have in Canada this group of conservative MAGA inspired influencers. I call them slopulist influencers, as I call them, and their shtick is always that is to just churn out a constant stream of demoralization and outrage, and about saying, oh, Canada's finished, it's over, oh, it's controlled by the World Economic Forum communists, 1984. It's just that and worship of Donald Trump. And the problem is that it's really just kind of hamstringing any effort to actually build a coherent political movement. And, well, I mean, MAGA is American. Now, it has some positives, some negatives, but I mean, it's positives of the positives of MAGA. Those appeal to Americans: the monster trucks, the fireworks, the eagles, Donald Trump's kind of audacious and very like confrontational attitude. The problem is that this is now what we face in Canada, is that this really goes against many Canadian sensibilities, and it's kind of tying the right in with things like this 51st state proposition, which is just ridiculous. And I don't think that, it's obviously never going to happen, but one of the problems that we have in Canada is now the right is kind of being lumped in with that. And you kind of saw that in the 2025 election this year, that it in many ways actually kind of helped the Liberals win, because a lot of the negativity was lumped onto the right just by association, because of this entire like MAGA social media slopulist scene.
When you talk about the bluster of Trump, are you referring to this sort of thing?
Yes, exactly.
Well,
right. I mean, yeah, exactly. And the problem is that it makes people feel good. It makes it makes MAGAtards feel good, feel like they're winning. But then it distracts from the actuality of someone like Donald Trump and of the fundamental issues. So like how many times, I'm sure you're pretty well aware of that meme: Europe has fallen, it's over, they shouldn't have given up their guns.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, this is what I would call slopulism. So The problem is that it's turning the right kind of into this clown show. Now, I'm not going to say that there weren't positives of this year, but I think this is something that people have to address. Like, what probably the most embarrassing example in Canada was that there was this ostrich farm that medical authority, that the wildlife authorities or whoever it was, they were going to euthanize the ostriches on this farm for whatever reason, something about some, I don't really remember the details of it, but kind of this sloppulist, right? People like Rebel Media and RFK and Robert Kennedy Jr., they all latched onto this. And then there in Canada, there was this months long saga from this kind of populist MAGA inspired right about this ostrich farm. It was a total non-issue. But you had, and it was really embarrassing. You had Ezra Levant going there and yelling at some RCMP officers. You had, I think it was Tamara Litch, like pretending to cry when the ostriches were being euthanized. And I mean, many people might not have even heard of this if they're not from Canada. But like, this was a thing. This went on for weeks and weeks in Canada. And what's so irritating about it is that it was just a big waste of time, a big distraction from the main issues. But also that if this had been liberals that were doing it, the same people would have said that that it was woke. So I mean, it's just kind of like this. It's just kind of politics as an entertainment product. Like it's like professional sports. So it's, well, because Mark Carney did this, well, then it's 1984 WEF. And, but then, if it had been the other way, if liberals had been protesting this ostrich farm, these ostriches being euthanized, oh, these woke liberals, oh, these woke leftists. It's a kind of becoming this, pretty, chronic problem on the right,
I can understand people being animated about this because nobody likes culls, unnecessary culls of animals. I can understand people getting pissed off and disgusted by it. Of course, as you say, it's nowhere near as important as The Great Replacement, for example.
Yeah, and then what you also see with the sloppulists is that Zionism is always laced into it somehow. So all these got these like 51st state people in Canada, all the ones that churn out these videos. Oh, Canada's fallen. Mark Carney, WEF, 1984. Then they always like find some way to lace Zionism into it. Like there's this really irritating guy on Twitter called Zachary Tisdale, and his entire thing, I mean, he's not even a civic nationalist. His entire thing is saying Canada should be absorbed by the US. And he says like, this will be such a blow to the World Economic Forum somehow. I don't understand how that's the case, but you can tell it's somebody who just judges politics based on like Trump memes. Like that's basically his entire worldview. It's those Trump memes, that picture of Trump riding a tank with the American flag. And that's basically his worldview. And then of course there's some Zionism laced in there. So it's like, Carney, recognize Palestine. This is a terror. And the thing is that like it's not serious politics. No one in the real world is actually going to take this thing seriously. No one in Canada, like the amount of people that would actually support the 51st state thing, it's minuscule from the right to the left. And secondly, like it's just never going to happen because that process would take years and years. But it's become this kind of slop narrative on X, and it does discredit the seriousness of the right in many ways.
Yeah, I agree. I think Javier Milei in Argentina, I think he seems to be almost an embodiment of this stuff, where everything he does and everything he says is slop. Everything he seems to constantly be operating on the level of slob, like even that publicity stunt with the chainsaw, and then his various statements about socialism. There seems to be no depth to him. I don't want to sort of dwell on him too much. I'm just using him as a sort of apex of this stuff, where there doesn't seem to be any depth whatsoever. It's just what will own or trigger the libs and make them look stupid, but also, I mean, massively pro-Israel.
Right. Yeah. And it's always in there. I mean, like another, like the other example is now in some ways, I think like the Trump administration talking about mass immigration in Europe and like kind of alluding to the Great Replacement. I have two kind of, I think that there are two ways to look at it. First of all, it is good that at least these ideas are being spoken, at least like more people are hearing them. They're actually being spoken about at a higher level. So that is a positive. But one of the problems also is that it kind of that it feels like they're you know what it feels like? It feels like Richard Nixon in 1969 or 1970 something coming out and saying he's against racism, because Richard Nixon, as we know from his private comments, he didn't believe in anti-racism or anything like that. There's even comments of him saying that he just does not believe that blacks are going to be as successful as whites are on average. He just doesn't believe that it's possible. But then he still implemented things like affirmative action, and even said like, I feel like it's being made my job to deny this reality. So he didn't believe it, but this was like now kind of the thing you had to say to be, this is the new consensus. So he was like kind of trying to adapt to it, even though he didn't really either believe it or understand it. I kind of feel that way with someone like Trump or Vance. Like I know Vance in his heart of hearts is not against the Great Replacement. He's literally married to the Great Replacement, but it seems like he kind of knows that to be relevant on the right, you actually have to take on these issues. You at least have to, you at least have to appear like you're actually addressing them. So, I mean, that is a positive. It is a positive that now, regardless of whether they believe it or not, the politicians at least have to give us some concessions, because kind of the nationalist right has become in some ways a constituent on the right. So that's a positive. But I think the negative would be that with the whole slopulism angle is that a lot of it, the talking points are kind of dumbed down. Like it's ridiculous for them to say that Europe's demographics are going to mean that they're not an ally of the US. Well, I mean, isn't the US going like 20 years ahead of Europe? I mean, most countries in Europe are still over 80% white. Some of them are over 90% white. So I feel like one of the problems is that it kind of opens you up to legitimate criticisms from the left, because the left can come out and say, for instance, the quote about Britain being J.D. Vance saying Britain's going to be the first Islamic country with nuclear weapons, which the problem with this quote is that Pakistan already has nuclear weapons, and it's a country which punishes blasphemy by death. But the left can just point out that that's obviously incorrect. Britain's not going to be is not going to become a Sharia country. The threat that Britain's facing is the Great Replacement. The threat that Britain's facing, I mean, Islam's part of that, but the broader threat is the British people becoming a minority. And in regards to demographics, the U.S. is worse off. So I think that, it's good that in some ways it's good that the talking points are getting out there, but also they really do need to be refined, because it is opening, it does open them up to legitimate criticism on the left.
Yeah, I agree. This thing about Islam, you get this, I see this on Twitter a lot. You'll get some news story and someone, like just this thing today in Bondi Beach, people will latch on to, he was brown. Was he Muslim? Was he Muslim? Was he a Muslim? And they're desperate that, let's hope that he was a Muslim, because then I can blame it on Islam. Well, I don't care really whether he was Muslim or not. He was brown, and he shouldn't have been in a white country for that reason alone.
Yeah, they did that with Southport. Much. Didn't they do that with Southport? That's saying, oh, he wasn't Muslim. He went to this Christian school, but he was a Rwandan.
Yeah.
I mean, he was born in Wales and he went to a Christian school.
Well, that's another thing that they get hung up on. Well, was he born here or not? Well, but as if that's some sort of arbitrary line that once they're born here, well, then that means they're not immigrants, and it means we didn't import the problem. So therefore, we can't. That matters. I don't think it does. I couldn't care less whether they were born here or not. I mean, Joanna Lumley was born in India. So was Rudyard Kipling. George Orwell, I think, was born in Burma. I can't remember. Maybe he was a policeman in Burma. But it doesn't matter. Jared Taylor was born in Japan. It doesn't matter. And I think that this is like the sort of last refuge for the civic nationalist to fixate on this stuff. And specifically the Islam angle. I mean, I realize why people are worried about Islam, and so am I. But it's only one part of this. If someone thinks it's okay for us to get racially replaced as long as it's not with the Islamic religion, then that person is retarded, as far as I'm concerned. They're just talking nonsense.
Yeah, and one thing you do see with that kind of sloposphere I mentioned earlier, and this problem we have on the Canadian right, is that for a couple of weeks ago, they spent people like Wyatt Claypool, or the same Zachary Tisdale guy, or this irritating basically Canadian version of the quartering called Clyde do something. They spent weeks attacking genuine Canadian nationalists, calling us racists and saying that that remigration is racist in Canada. You're woke right. And I know that you've had a lot to say about that. You've had a lot to say about that. about that whole
thing. Yeah. I can't remember if that had, first of all, just let me say about those guys, that's amazing. Again, that's like buying a new pair of flared trousers in 1980. You know, saying at this point that, real nationalism, there's just no place for real nationalism. Fuck you. That's your years behind the curve at this point, if you're saying stuff like that. Well, and remigration is racist. Piss off. We want our countries back. It's as simple as that.
And one of the positives is that they have lost that argument. Like they get ratioed on every post they make about that.
Exactly.
So it's still there, but it is really losing. Like I don't think there's much a future in that kind of civic nationalism.
No, I don't think so. I've actually forgotten what the thing was I was going to pick up on that you just said about a minute ago.
Well, it was about how these kind of slop conservative influencers spent several weeks just attacking people in Canada calling for remigration. So, the funny thing is with a lot of these influencers is that their content is always just like a constant stream of outrage. So it's like they'll have a video every day saying like, outrage, Mark Carney implements 1984, WEF. But then when there's someone who actually offers a genuine solution, then it's, oh, that's woke right.
That was it. That was what I was going to pick up on, was the woke right thing. So, yeah, I can't remember whether that had started before last millennial. I think it probably
it was just starting. It was just starting with James Lindsay back in the end of 2024.
Yeah, that's feels right. But obviously this year it massively picked up, and to peaking probably with Benjamin Netanyahu changing it to a woke Reich, which was, I guess there were high fives in some scripting department somewhere when they came up with that.
Have they lost touch?
Yeah, by the time it hit the public, it was just, it fell flat. It was nonsense. But the whole, I wrote an essay about the woke right concept earlier this year. So I've dealt with it there. Also dealt with it on Twitter. There was a Venn diagram that I came up with because I realized, this interview is supposed to be about you, Endeavor, but I'll just briefly say this because a lot of people who follow me on other platforms might not be aware of my activity on Substack and Twitter. I noticed that people who use the term woke right usually were also pro-Zionist or pro-Israel. Even if they didn't call themselves Zionists, you would find them defending Israel and defending the IDF and so forth. And eventually I started to make make a list of people. And each time I saw someone using the term, I would have a look at their profile and do a search. And in all but one instance, the person was a Zionist. And I realized that there's total overlap here. Thus, the term is simply a Zionist weapon. It's simply a way to mock right-wingers who aren't being pro-Israel. It's to get them in line. And that's what the whole idea is with that term woke right. It's to embarrass them because you're on the right, so, and you know that wokery is on the left, so you don't want to be woke. You don't want to be called that because that means you're sort of spiritually left wing. So it's a sort of humiliation ritual. It's a mockery. And the whole point behind it was to keep people on the neocon plantation where you love the Jews, you're pro-Israel, and you're anti-immigration. But you never notice who pushes mass immigration,
right?
Ever.
I mean, yeah. What's ironic is like this guy, like for one example, would be this Wyatt Claypool guy in Canada who's calling people calling for remigration, genuine Canadian nationalists. He's calling them racists and everything like that. He put the word Zionist in his profile. Now, I mean, if he were a smart shill, he wouldn't just out and out advertise his conflict of interest, but. In doing so, he's basically saying that he endorses mass murder in the name of Israeli nationality, but Canadians wanting to peacefully reverse mass immigration, that's beyond the pale. So, I
should qualify what I said. You, according to this lens, you can be anti-immigration, but you must never, ever be like. An ethno-nationalist. You can, as a white person, that makes you a Nazi. So you've got to be pro-Jewish ethno-nationalism because you're a Zionist, but you cannot possibly want the same thing for your own people. And if you do, then you're woke right. And I'll just briefly show the Venn diagram. This is the current version of it. As you can see, I had to make the text smaller and smaller and smaller as I kept discovering more people. Now, there was one person in the left circle who I found using woke right, but who wasn't a Zionist. But because she was a small account, so I thought this isn't fair. It feels like I'm sort of bullying her. So I removed her from the diagram. But that was it. That was the only non-overlap there was some woman who'd inadvertently started using this, not realizing that it was a weapon of Zionists. Now, as I say, all of those names in the middle are all Zionists and they all use woke right. You can't really find Zionists who don't use it. And you can't, as I say, you can't find people using it who aren't Zionists. It's amazing. The overlap is just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I will say that one thing that's positive is I do feel like that kind of social media operation was just dead on arrival. Like, I'm even convinced that people like James Lindsay, I think they might even just be paying for likes because when you look at their responses, they're entirely negative. And for a while, they were just getting ratioed on every post. But now they have their likes are outpacing their replies, but every single reply is negative. So I'm actually thinking,
yeah.
I don't know if they are or not. It could be engagement farming. It could not be. But I don't think that kind of operation from the Zionist lobby has just fallen flat on its face. I don't think because at this point, anyone on the right who is pro-Israel, either they're Jewish, they're over the age of 70, or they're paid to be so.
Yeah, well, exactly. That's a whole thing in itself that I think we should maybe carefully talk about. And this has been happening for the last two. I remember talking about it on Millennial 2 years ago with Keith Woods, and it was definitely a thing last year as well. But I think this year it's really come to home to roost. The collapse of Israel's international PR, their image abroad. Obviously it's a difficult issue to talk about tactfully, but would you have anything to say about that? Because I do think it's very, very important.
Oh, well, I mean, I don't know if I have a very unique take on it, but yeah, it feels like it's like they're like the Zionist lobby, they know that their days are numbered, that once these, you know, 75-year-old senators from Iowa, these evangelical guys at these mega churches, once they kick the bucket, which, you know, considering that they're 75 and overweight, won't be that long. I think that their support is done for.
Because their communication, as you alluded to earlier, that they used to be so much better at this stuff.
Somehow they're propaganda. Yeah,
maybe it's the competence crisis. Exactly. And maybe it's the competence crisis, or maybe it's just that they're defending the obviously indefensible at this stage. But one way or another, yeah, their propaganda is dreadful. And the woke right thing, I think they thought that was going to be a huge barnstormer of a success. And it was just a damp squib from the very start.
And these people are, and like James Lindsay doesn't come across as an intelligent person to me. Like, I mean, all he does is just throws out the names of various philosophers as if just name dropping some intellectual is this stroke of brilliance. But he doesn't strike me as somebody who's very intelligent at all. And I get the sense that with the people you put on that list, they don't come across as very intelligent people. And I'm not just saying that because they're political opponents. I mean, there are people that were involved with the left and many liberals who were genuinely intelligent people. But, you know, people like Joel Barry, James Lindsay, Constantine Kissin, they all really just kind of seem at like mediocrities to me. They're not very insightful. They so obviously have a conflict of interest, because what is the selling point at this? What is the selling point of Zionism for anyone in the West? Is it just the residual guilt that people might have over World War II? Because that's what they were going on for decades and decades, and it actually worked. But, what's the selling point? From the perspective of just an average person in the West, why do they care about Israel? Why? I don't care about it. It has nothing to do with us. So
I wrote about this about a month ago. I published two essays about Zionism in America and Zionism in Britain. And I made this point that I think people are reverting to the historical norm, which is being concerned about their own country, their own town, their own family, and their own nationhood, their ethnic group to some extent, in the face of mass immigration. So I think it was a sort of historical aberration that people were so, that anyone was so concerned about and obsessed with a desert country in the Middle East. I mean, it doesn't make sense. It's obviously ridiculous. And I think it wasn't the norm. And I think it's, it relied on a certain moment in time, the Holocaust guilt and the power of the television and the power of Hollywood. And all of these things are now on the wane. The mainstream media is on the wane. So, I think people are just reverting to default, which is, okay, what about me? What about my life? What about the things I know? What about the things I see every day? What about the people I love? How is any of this going to be maintained? Where is consistency? Where is predictability in my life? I don't see it. And I think that's annoying people. Sorry, go on.
Well, there's also just this massive narcissism from them as well, because you'd think that seeing what's happening on the left and seeing the demographics and how, some Jews even wrote about this 20 years ago, but that a demographically non-white America or Western world is not going to be very friendly to them. You'd think that seeing that, some of them might actually think, and then now to their credit, a few of them do, but not very many. You think they might think, okay, let's cut it with the woke stuff. Let's cut it with the anti-white stuff. And you know, we'll just let them have their remigration. But then they have this whole woke right thing. So even at this late hour, they're still demanding that you have no ethnic interests yourself, but that their ethnic interests are absolutely sacrosanct to you. At this late hour, they're still demanding that. I mean, this is what I think is going to be the main main catalyst of the downfall of the Zionist lobby is just this ethno-narcissism that it seems like strategically it might even make sense for them to just kind of adopt many of our more genuine talking points about things like, well, we need remigration. We don't want whites to become a minority. It might actually make sense, but it just seems like the Zionist lobby and many Jews are just incapable of fathoming the idea that someone else might have ethnic interests of their own, and that that might be important to them, more important to them than your ethnic interests. So they think that that Jewish ethnic interests should be absolutely sacrosanct to everybody else, but then if you actually have any interests of your own, well, then that's Nazism and woke right, as they say.
Yeah, it's amazing. They want to simultaneously secure their own homeland while ensuring that we won't have any homeland in the future. That's just it's not just unreasonable. It's outrageous.
I think that. Do you want to say something? Because what I wanted to say.
I think I would just leave it at that. I mean, I think, as you say, the word is narcissism, and it's just too visible now. It's too obvious. One thing I will say before, just hold the thought that you were going to move on to. One thing I will say is I think this has been an absolutely ruinous year for Ben Shapiro, and I just love it. I love it because he epitomizes this utter arrogance and contempt and loathing for us white people.
He said that if you can't afford to live in the city that you were born in, then maybe you shouldn't be living there.
Yes, that was the epitome of it. But even before that, he had said various other things. Again, their PR game is dreadful now. I mean, the thing to do. I don't want to give them ideas, but the thing for them to do at this point is to agree with us that there needs to be mass deportations. Remigration is now a necessity, and then that will get us on board, at least some of us, with Zionism. Okay, if you support us with our ethno-nationalism, we'll support you with yours. That would be the common sense thing for them to do, but they just can't. And of course, with Ben Shapiro, there's that infamous tweet that will haunt him forever, which is, I don't give a good damn about the so-called Browning of America. I've seen it so many times that I can remember it off by heart, verbatim. I mean, I guess he could just say, he could change his mind on that and say, I've seen sense that I was drunk, whatever, it was a long time ago. He could. But it would take a lot of work to make anyone believe that. I think that his reputation, his credibility is shot after this year. I think he's a joke. And I look forward to seeing his decline.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm in agreement that I feel like the Zionist lobby, they've lost any kind of coherent narrative. They don't have any genuine support anymore. I wanted to change gears a little because there is this other problem kind of related to this and kind of related to what I was talking about earlier that's emerged on the right. One thing I mentioned about the GOP flubbing Charlie Kirk's assassination was that they kind of turned it into this big PR campaign and then didn't actually do anything, didn't do enough substantive things with it. I think that the problem with the online right was that it became this big spectacle as well, but in a different way. And this is what I call the conspiratard problem. Now, I mean, I guess I'll preface this by saying that I'm not somebody who thinks that any kind of conspiracy theory is ludicrous. Conspiracies do happen. Like something like COVID, was the official narrative on COVID correct? I think it was not. I think it was pretty clearly incorrect. However, I think that kind of healthy skepticism, and it was understandable during COVID because my goodness, was that a nightmare to endure? But I feel like that kind of healthy skepticism has morphed into what's kind of become this schizophrenic attitude on the right that every single event has to have been planned out by Israel, and that everything is a conspiracy theory and that everything's a psyop. And if that anything happens, well, then it must have been planned out by somebody ahead of time. I mean, we've just been going over how really incompetent the Zionist lobby has become. I think that many people are giving them too much agency when they think that they have this ability to carry out all of these mass casualty events and orchestrate all of these conspiracies. And I think that the Charlie Kirk thing was, I mean, this response was a disaster. The initial response of the right to go after the left, attack their moral legitimacy, say that somebody who was radicalized by your rhetoric murdered a man in broad daylight and you're out there celebrating it. The correct course of action was to go for the jugular, like the left did with George Floyd. But I mean, that happened for a few days, but then someone like Candace Owens or someone like Ian Carroll entered the picture, and then it became this big spectacle for conspiracy theories. And then even before Charlie Kirk's body hit the ground, there were people out there already saying, oh, Israel assassinated Charlie Kirk. I mean, it was just ridiculous. First of all, there's no, when something happens within 5 minutes, nobody's going to know what actually happened. You're just assuming that that's the case. But then as details emerged, we have this Tyler Robinson. We have the fact that he confessed to his family and to the tranny he was in a relationship with. We have the fact that his parents turned him in. We have the fact that we know he was radicalized to the left. He had anti-fascist iconography. He had anti-fascist slogans written on the shell casings. Tyler Robinson killed Charlie Kirk. I'm like 95% sure that that's the case. But this segment of the right seems incapable of just accepting that that might have actually happened. And they've spent the last several months, I mean, in my view, just writing fan fictions about how it was some kind of Mossad operation. Whereas, I mean, yeah, and keep in mind, the same people who are now saying that would have said a day before Charlie Kirk's death, they would have called him an Israel shill. And the problem with this is that it really distracted from the opportunity that was nailing the left and attacking their moral legitimacy and gaining as much ground off of that as possible. And instead, a lot of people like Candace Owens have just led a bunch of people on this wild goose chase where now it's not even just Israel. Now it's Erica Kirk, PPUSA, the CIA, Egypt, France, the Macrons, Angola. Apparently they're all in on Charlie Kirk's assassination. And it's just been this big clown show. And it's not even just podcasters. And because there's this politician in Canada who I actually thought did good work during COVID. His name was Randy Hillier. And
I found it.
During COVID, he was one of the politicians that actually took a stand against the tyranny. Yesterday on Twitter, he posted that if Candace Owens had been around in 1963, the JFK assassination wouldn't be a mystery. And I just replied, do you actually believe this? And he's like, oh, are you afraid of me asking questions? And this is supposed to be a serious right-leaning politician, somebody who was a member of provincial parliament a couple of years ago. And someone like him has been taken in by this, this conspiracy rabbit hole. And it doesn't actually make people more based. All it does is it just makes any kind of meaningful political action impossible because everything is planned out. If you actually do anything good, well, that's just because the elites or the Zionists or whoever your bad guy is, that's because they planned for that to happen. If you try to start an organization, well, then it's a honeypot, and then you're going to just give all of those names over to Mossad. And I think that the whole conspiracy rabbit hole is really becoming this chronic problem on the right. And in addition to the slopulism thing that I mentioned earlier, which they're both kind of related, but I think this is one of the major problems on the right is that there's just this tendency to interpret every single event that happens in the world as some kind of conspiracy. And it's granting way, way more agency and competence to our enemies than they really deserve.
I one thing I'll say is I think with Randy Hillier, because I remember him, I'm sure he was the one during COVID, he would stood up in Parliament and was talking about this provision that was in a new law to what would be the word?
It was internment camps in Ontario. It was in the provincial parliament. Yeah.
I remember a wide latitude of reasons to put people in here. And he was outraged by this, and he asked the question, and the parliament just ignored him and moved on to another question. Kudos to him for doing that. It was nice to know that at least one politician in Canada was speaking up for common sense at that time. It seems to me that politicians of a certain age, or politicians who are a bit normy still, they're aware that something's not right, but they're still quite normy. They sort of default to conspiracy thinking because they think, and it's always one conspiracy as well, it's the Nazis. Like this one here, for example, this is a meme about the EU, right? This sort of thing. Right? I mean, it's preposterous. But I've had boomers saying to me that this kind of, you see it all the time on Twitter and probably Facebook as well, that, the EU is the Third Reich. They transformed into this. This is what happened. They just changed their flag, but it's really the same people. It's the same mentality. And then, of course, with reference to Canada, you get this sort of thing. The woke are Nazis, and you know, I don't know how seriously they take that, but it's this idea that everything's a conspiracy, because ironically that helps them to evade saying things or contemplating things that are too dangerous for them to contemplate. So I think they default to this kind of thing. I think it's a knee-jerk protective maneuver for people who, as I say, are either too old to change or they're normies. And they're scared of seeing the full picture. So instead they go for this kind of nonsense. I think that is a tendency.
Well, I think that might be the case with some of the older ones. I mean, but Randy Hillier, he's woke on the Israel question. I mean, he's a boomer, but he actually has criticized Israel.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the issue is not that, it's not the whole Israel thing that's the issue. The issue is believing that it's going down the Candace Owens like rabbit hole and just joining that entire clown circus.
The Frankists. I take the point, and I think that Candace Owens, the problem is that she doesn't. Well, first of all, I think she's got too big an audience, and I think it's gone to her head somewhat. I think she's not rigorous. She doesn't check, she doesn't stop and think, well, hold on, is this likely? Yeah, I can make it seem true, but is it likely to actually be true? And this obsession that she has with the Macrons and I've forgotten the woman's, well,
Bridget Macron.
Yeah, Bridget. I've forgotten. Yeah, this thing about Bridget Macron being a man, it doesn't actually matter. I mean, it's like you get people who will say, you know, Tony Blair, he was arrested for cottaging when he was a student. So what? He's a fucking war criminal who transformed Britain out of recognition. I mean, who cares whether he is gay? It doesn't matter. It doesn't make any difference to what he's actually done to the country. And likewise, it's actually inconsequential if Bridget Macron is a man or not. I mean, I know it's funny and it's interesting, but it doesn't actually make any difference.
But yeah, and with the, this isn't just like a boomer thing, though, because this is something which many of the conspiracy theories, seem like the biggest ones, were that Israel killed Charlie Kirk, which, I mean, as everyone knows from the rest of the stream and all the work I've done, I'm no fan of Israel. And I think that kind of goes without saying, but they're not the only people that ever actually put anything into action. It is a lot more likely that a gay college age student who was in a relationship with a transgender was radicalized to the left and thought Charlie Kirk was a fascist and murdered him because he thought that he was transphobic. That's a lot more likely of an explanation than that this was somehow orchestrated by Mossad because Charlie Kirk was going to turn against the movement or something like that. Like, it doesn't even make sense, because the whole anti-Israel stuff, that's only gotten a lot more light since Charlie Kirk's death, with Nick Fuentes going on Piers Morgan, on Tucker Carlson, and all of that stuff. So, I mean, like, and Charlie Kirk, up until very recently, was actually pro-Israel. So wouldn't it have made more sense to go after someone like Tucker Carlson instead? But the problem that I'm seeing emerge is that there's this attitude on the right that it's not even just the right. It's true about the left as well. But I mean, I'm more concerned about it on the right. It's that you have this tendency to just interpret everything as if it's just going to reaffirm what you already believe. So when something happens, well, then even before you have any information about it, well, then you just assume, well, this affirms my ideology. And they say, and they'll always say, like, they're questioning the official narrative. But what you notice with what I call conspiratards, when they say they question the official narrative, they only ever come to the conclusion that what they already believed is actually what happened. Like, they never come to the conclusion that it was actually something else which happened, because they're not actually objectively analyzing info. They're just trying to shoehorn it into a preconceived worldview. I mean, if you look at it on the flip side, Jimmy Kimmel came out on TV and said that Charlie Kirk's murderer was a far right MAGA supporter. Was Jimmy Kimmel just questioning the official narrative, or was he just outright lying to advance his own political opinion? Well, it was obviously the latter. And I just ask that people on the right actually look at it from that kind of perspective, that it's possible for something to just happen in the world. Not everything is some kind of grand conspiracy by, you know, the WEF or by the Zionists or by whoever your chosen bad guy is. Because what ended up happening is that a few days ago, I saw Jack Posobiec on, I think it was on Fox News, and he was trying to plead with people saying, Tyler Robinson murdered Charlie Kirk. His family turned him in. If he weren't guilty, why would they turn him in? Why wouldn't they be proclaiming his innocence? Someone like Jack Posobiec, he should be out there going after the left. But instead, he, like, because of this, like, conspiratard circus created by people like Candace Owens and Ian Carroll, he has to go out there and do damage control on the right. What this has done is it's kind of let that pressure off of the left when we should have been going for the jugular and just hammering them on this moral indictment. But instead, so much of the energy on the right was absorbed by this. When you contrast that with something like George Floyd was some random felon and drug addict, whereas Charlie Kirk was one of the biggest, probably the biggest conservative influencer in the United States. But the left got, like, think about how much ground the left gained off of George Floyd's death. Just like, and we now know that he died of a fentanyl overdose, but just that image of Derek Chauvin's knee on George Floyd's back. The left got it such that corporate America in 2021, that they had this statistic which they released that I think of S&P 100 companies in the United States, 94% of the new hires in 2021, following the George Floyd saga in 2020, the riots and everything, 94% of the new hires were non-white. So what the left gained out of George Floyd was that corporate America for the next 2-3 years didn't hire white people at all. That's the ground that they gained off of that. And they didn't even care about the truth. Whereas the right, I mean, they got a bit of ground off of the Charlie Kirk, just initially off of his murder, but then it kind of just dissipated and turned into this conspiratard clown circus. And if I were even just like a pure Machiavellian, let's assume that I just don't even care about the truth at all. What would be the, and I only cared about advancing my political cause. Well, then the narrative that a anti-fascist, homosexual, transgender loving leftist murdered Charlie Kirk in broad daylight because he had been radicalized to the left. That's the most effective narrative to advance my cause. And I think that that's what's the truth. I mean, the left obviously didn't care about the truth about George Floyd. They just went straight for the political and they gained all that ground. And I really feel like it was a lost opportunity. And it's kind of because of this chronic problem of conspiratorial thinking on the right, which I'll say that it's okay to be skeptical of things. It's okay to ask questions, but I feel like this has just become this big, in some ways entertainment, but also just this chronic like distrust of anything. And it's not very productive.
Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. I am open to the idea that it was that there's more to it than we're being told that we're seeing. But I think ideally that discussion and that investigation would happen in a low-key way without dominating the narrative. And it wouldn't be seized upon and then insisted upon against rising evidence. And at any rate, it wouldn't be allowed to dilute our efforts in the political realm. That would be the ideal. And I think this actually ties into your objection to sloppulism, because really the reason this did damage, to the extent that it did, the reason that happened was that it interfaced with the whole sloppulism thing and became this circus. Yeah, exactly. If it had just stayed as a bunch of people studiously, seriously investigating, that would have been a different thing. But instead, it came to dominate, and in quite a lowbrow and silly way. I mean, I think that what Candace Owens is doing now, at this point, it just seems silly. So I agree with everything you're saying here. And I think another aspect of this is that the right just doesn't have the experience or the expertise in campaigning and making use of events. So when the George Floyd, I don't even think the George Floyd thing happened because of George Floyd. I think that they had this campaign ready, locked and loaded, and they were just waiting for some black guy to get killed by some white cop or you know, whatever, for it is a case where that could be made the narrative. And as soon as one came up, it goes, it's the button's pressed and the whole thing happened. I think that's how it played out with him. I think they already had it all planned. They knew exactly what they were going to do and roughly what the narratives would be and how to handle the objections and how to persuade people, et cetera, et cetera. They've got decades of experience doing this. So, and, you know, I don't want to get hung up on whether it was pre-planned or not. It doesn't make any difference. Again, I'm just saying I suspect that it was that they were just waiting for a sufficient pretext to launch this whole thing, this what we now call the summer of Floyd, the summer of BLM. So in contrast, the right are always on the defensive. They certainly don't have campaigns locked and loaded ready. But even when something happens, you could say it's related, it's the same thing. Even when something happens, they're not ready. They don't know how to use it. They don't know how to exploit it. And so with Charlie Kirk, that should have just been ground zero for transforming America. Even like the institution of the American university should have been revolutionized off the back of what happened with Charlie Kirk.
Well, it should have just been over for the anti-fascist left. There's any amount of moral legitimacy that they had. That should have just been it. Now, it did take a hit, but it wasn't a death blow, though.
No, and then there's all the educators at the universities. You've got to start looking into, okay, what are you teaching? What are you saying? Not to the students, but to the people who teach the students, the lecturers. And this goes at school as well. What's going on in the teacher training colleges? So you'd have to, like, root and branch, reform these institutions or just abolish them. which I think is maybe on the horizon anyway for mainstream education, for formal education, but that's a different matter. The point is, it should have been the pretext that the right needed to seize what they want. And instead, it was this floundering, flailing, well, we're going to do this, we're going to monitor the situation, and we're going to take real decisive action, and blah, de, blah, de, blah. And 3 months on, there's just not much evidence of that. Now, I don't want to be a complete poo-pooer here, because maybe they are. I mean, they've designated Antifa internationally a terrorist organization. Maybe that will happen. Maybe that good things will come from that. But at any rate, I think a lot of momentum has just been squandered. It's just been pissed away here.
And I think that part of this is the whole conspiracy rabbit hole circus that people like Candace Owens and Ian Carroll have started. One thing that I wanted to add on to this is that, not that I want to launch a conspiracy off of a conspiracy, but on Telegram, I'm getting promoted ads for Charlie Kirk assassination conspiracy theories. So I'm getting on Telegram, I'm getting these ads. So somebody's paying for this to show up on my Telegram feed saying the truth, they hid it. Click here to find out what actually happened to Charlie Kirk. And I mean, it could be a genuine crank that's putting this stuff out. I mean, a year ago on Telegram, it was QAnon that was being promoted and things about aliens building the pyramids. It could be a genuine crank, or it could be somebody who realizes that putting these kind of conspiracies out into the right wing space and just polluting the discourse with this rubbish, that's actually very effective at hamstringing the right's ability to take any decisive political action. Because what you see right now is all these conservative influencers in the U.S. who should be out there hunting down leftists and taking scalps and getting them kicked out of their positions of power. Instead, they're out having to play damage control for this forest fire that Candace Owens has started on the right. I mean, another thing that I don't understand with people like this is what do they expect to achieve? What's the strategic aim of these conspiracies? For example, is the goal to convince me that Israel is bad? I mean, I've believed that for the last 7 or 8 years now, and at this point, I think 90% of people do. So it's not even that strategically advantageous to push these conspiracies, and I don't even think that they're even true. So I think that this is something people need to take seriously as a genuine problem on the right, because there was kind of this attitude, and it's from COVID, and I get it because COVID was obviously a nightmare, but the attitude is that you're more based if you don't believe the official narrative on something, and that if you believe anything that the mainstream media says, well then you're a sheep, or you're naive, and that there's this kind of this desire to always have the most novel hot take on anything that happens in the news and find some way to explain it out as some kind of plot. And unfortunately, though, it this kind of attitude really does just prevent any successful political action, because when somebody actually says, hey, I'm going to start a political organization, then the response is, oh, it's a psyop. Oh, they're trying to collect names. Oh, they're a Fed.
I agree. That happened this year.
A major problem on the right.
Yeah, the paranoia. I mean, that happened this year in Britain with the flag thing. I don't think that was the state or feds or whatever, but a lot of people just assumed it was, and I think that's a shame
because it happened. People thought it was that feds did it because the assumption is that if anything actually happens, it's because the people in power wanted it to happen. And I think that the other problem is that it's assigning way too much power to them. It's making a god out of your enemy, which also kind of hamstrings your ability to have to act effectively, because then that under that mindset you're not going to be able to do anything, because they'll just outflank you and then psyop you with something.
Yeah exactly. Okay, well, this has been a very interesting tour of 2025 and the various threads that stem from it. We'll get to the super chats now, and there are a few. Don says, thank you. Well, thank you, Don. He Brews says, Merry Christmas all. Thank you very much. The Thin Red Line said, thank you for another great conversation. Thank you. And Justin said, do you think a more effective argument to use when talking with a lefty about migrant violence would be that non-whites will inevitably feel alienated here, and that will exacerbate violent tendencies, rather than arguing that certain groups are more violent by their nature, the biological nature? The latter seems to trigger a defensiveness in many liberals. So what do you think, Endeavour? Do you think we should emphasise that they will feel alienated and that they don't fit in here and that will exacerbate violence? Or do you think we should concentrate on their inherent nature?
I think probably concentrate on the inherent nature. Because, first of all, I think that the narrative has to be that our own interests are legitimate. We're against mass immigration because it's bad for us, that we have the right to have our own countries, and that the fact that we want this for ourselves is morally just. I think that has to be the message. The other thing is, I will say that I think with leftists, they support mass immigration because it's ultimately just like a suicide cult. They support whatever's bad for white countries. So that's why, I mean, I know this is not a new talking point or anything, but that's why you'll see this contradiction that they want to import Muslims while they support feminism and LGBT, because they just support whatever is destructive. So I find with leftists, if we're talking like the far left, it's impossible, because like they'll even deny that if you bring up things like housing prices, bring up things like wage stagnation, they don't care about that stuff, because what comes first and foremost is destroying white countries for most radical leftists. So I find it's just not going to work overall.
Yeah, I agree with you. And the other thing is, if you concentrate on immigrants feeling alienated, then the leftist will simply say, well, that's down to us.
They'll say that it's our racism that's making them feel alienated.
Exactly. And we just need to put more money into the programs to help them integrate, and then they won't feel alienated. So I don't think that, I mean, I understand, and I think it's worth saying, it's worth dropping in there that, well, you know, if you introduce loads of people, they're just going to feel alienated. So it's worth saying, but I wouldn't pursue it. I think the thing to pursue, the key thing to preserve in the conversation is, this is our homeland. We exist. We deserve a homeland, and this is our homeland. Those three precepts. And they can take issue with them, but, and then you can concentrate on that. Because it is the truth. If anyone else deserves a homeland, then so do we. If anyone else exists, then so do we. If anyone else has a homeland, then so do we. The contradictions are just obvious. And then, of course, what they'll say to that is, ah, yes, but we invited them over. And then you can say, no, we didn't. No, we just did not. That's bullshit. So, that's what I would say. Claude made... He drew attention to the old saying among the skeptics about people like us, that they would call us right-wing SJWs. And he's likening that to the woke right concept. And I actually, I agree with you. It's ultimately the same thing. It's the same idea, horseshoe theory and all that. And I talked about this in my essay about the issue. So I'll just, if anyone is curious, I'll link to that now in Odyssey and Rumble. I think people would probably get quite a lot out of that essay if they were to read it. It's one that I'm proud of. I dealt with it there, and just to say, it's basically the same thing. It's just that the woke right is like the right wing SJWs.
That was coming from YouTubers. The woke right thing is coming from the Zionist lobby.
Exactly. One of them, the right wing SJWs, was a gotcha by the likes of Sargon, and he did use it. He absolutely did use and spread that back in the day. And I know he's changed. I know he's moved on, but that was a thing back in the day. It was a bunch of guys who didn't really know what they were doing. The woke right is from the Zionist lobby, who supposedly do know what they're doing and are good at it. And yet, it's, as we said earlier, it's just completely fallen flat.
Well, the fact that they had to dig up a meme from several years earlier, which wasn't even successful at that. I mean, I don't think they dug up the meme. I think that they just came up with it independently. But the fact that it was already out, it had already been out of date for 4 or 5 years when they started using it, shows just their lack of imagination. Yeah.
And it had been dealt with then. But in any case, the circumstances had changed since then, since 2016. And at this point, people are just thinking, look, I want my country back. I just want normality back. And calling them woke, it just doesn't wash. It just doesn't work. I don't think it anyone takes that seriously.
I mean, it's like the whole thing of saying that the left are the real racists or something like that, or everybody know, or that the left are Nazis or something. Everyone knows that that's not correct. And it's the same way, like saying that people who want nationalists, people who want their own homeland, people who believe that whites should have an ethnic identity. Saying that that's woke, everybody knows that that's incorrect on an instinctual level. And that's why James Lindsay has had like 20 different definitions of what the woke right is. It's like it's Neoplatonism mixed with Marxian critical theory with Foucault, postmodern, all this like, you know, it's intellectual, verbal diarrhea. This is the woke right. But everyone in their right mind knows that no, wanting your own homeland is not woke.
Exactly. It's not even ideological. It's just a simple manifestation of human nature to want a place that where you belong. To take issue with that and call someone ideologically demented is ridiculous. And again, I think it shows just how stranded the civic nationalist, but also the classical liberal is at this point in time. If he thinks that it's somehow perverse to want a place of your own in the world, I'm afraid that just makes him the outsider to sanity. And I think that's an interesting switch that's happened over the last 5 years or so or less. The classical liberal used to be a very smug figure and now just looks completely out of touch and unable to deal with reality. I've found that a very interesting thing
because
to observe.
Because I find someone like that, or someone like Jordan Peterson, for example, that entire ideology, the civic nationalism, classic liberal, whatever you want to call it, that is born out of a lack of courage. It's born out of not liking the direction things are going, but being too cowardly to address the fundamental issues. So they kind of create this logically inconsistent ideology, which allows them to, you know, push back in a very trivial way, but still tell themselves that they're good people under the dominant morality. And that's why it's fallen apart. It's because it's something which is just, it's a worldview that's born out of a denial of the actual root of the problem.
Yeah. And also a denial of the fact that the dominant morality is invalid. I think that's for someone like Jordan Peterson, you can probably, I think it'd be quite accurate to say that that is the root of his torment, that he's defending a morality, a moral system that it just doesn't work. It just doesn't work anymore. It worked in a greenhouse of a largely homogenous society. But as soon as you have diversity at any rate, at any scale, that morality just falls apart. It's a suicide cult. It's not actually a morality. All right. So let's move on. Dardy said, happy to be listening to Endeavor once again on Millennial. Does he think remigration will be embraced by Canadians and their Conservative Party in the future, like other mainstream right-wing parties, both in Europe and America? Or will Canada continue down the path of being a kind of woke North Korea?
No, I actually am a bit more optimistic about that because, I mean, this kind of goes back on the to the thing I was talking about earlier about with sloppulism, that one of the problems is that the only thing you ever hear about Canada is just the negative. You just see the Trudeau memes, the fast food restaurants full of Indians, and the country is in a bad state, but I'm actually quite optimistic that a lot of our ideas have made quite a bit of headway in this past year. So like now there's an organization called the Dominion Society. It's an organization that's devoted to advocating remigration. And within that started only a couple months ago, only 4 or 5 months ago, and it already has over 1,500 members who've signed up, myself included. I feel like Canada it'll go the way that the rest of the West does. So if remigration starts happening in Western Europe and or the United States, it'll happen in Canada too. I don't think that Canada is as devoted to globo homo as some people might believe.
Right. I mean, Justin Trudeau was probably an outlier in that regard. You're muted.
Oh, sorry. Hello. Yeah. No, I mean, yeah. Justin Trudeau was, I mean, yeah, but again, he was kind of, he was a thing of that, you know, the Great Awakening era, and that's already gone out of fashion. And like another thing is that immigration is actually very unpopular in Canada, just like in the rest of the Western world. There was a statistic out of National Post this past year that said that I think that 65% of the country wanted immigration either drastically reduced or just ended, and then about 45%, so almost half of the country, wanted deportations. So there certainly is a market there. The thing is that we still have the same like hostile ruling class, but you know, but they've even had to make concessions because A, the pressure has built up against them, but B, the reality of the worldview has just manifest itself, and it's not good.
Yeah. And that links to the UK meme over here, but everyone else has got their own version of that. Okay, Darty also said, thank you, Endeavour, for touching on the conspiratard problem on our side, which unfortunately I don't think has peaked yet.
Well, I mean, Candace Owens is still raking in millions and millions of views. I think in a year, based on her view count alone, she's going to be made several million dollars. So, well, I don't know. This seems like it's QAnon 2.0. I don't think it's peaked yet, but I just hope it doesn't become this chronic problem on the right for years and years.
Yeah, definitely. And then Dardy made a very generous super chat. Thank you very much, Dardy. And he said, hope this also gets discussed during the Canadian banquet, but what are Endeavour's thoughts on the Tim Hortons lobby and the more recent attacks on private property in Canada by leftist courts, declaring actually it is the Aboriginals that own land and that your home or business is built on?
Well, on the first question, well, Tim Hortons, if anyone doesn't know, this is our most popular coffee chain. So it's like the Canadian version of Starbucks. And it kind of became this symbol of Canada, like the liberal civic nationalism of the 2000s. Like, we drink Tim Hortons, not Starbucks. So it became this big national icon. Well, what Tim Hortons was doing was that they're lobbying the government for basically for mass immigration, for increasing the number of temporary foreign workers. So we had in Britain, you guys had the Boris wave, and the same time period in Canada, we had the Trudeau wave, which was when mass immigration was just ramped up to ridiculous levels. I mean, it was already high before that, but it was increased like threefold from like 2021 to about 2024. The Carney government has actually scaled that back a little. Don't want to celebrate too much. It's basically just going back to Trudeau 1.0. But Tim Hortons, this coffee chain, what they've done is they're now trying to lobby the government to increase the number of temporary foreign workers again. We have a meme in Canada. So like Tim Hortons, the slogan is always fresh. So the commercials always said Tim Hortons always fresh, but now we call it Sing Hortons, and we say Sing Hortons always shit. So boycott them. If you buy Tim Hortons, you're supporting the invasion. As for the Aboriginal land claims. Well, I mean, it's a ridiculous ruling. So what people, if I mean, I haven't read everything that's out there on that, but I have read a couple of articles about it. Basically, that what happened was that I think it was the court in BC ruled that the Crown, that being the Canadian government, that their sovereignty doesn't, or that Indigenous land claims predate the sovereignty of the Canadian state. That's basically saying that there's a chance that we don't have sovereignty over our own land. I mean, I don't think this is actually going to result in a bunch of people losing their private property. But it just goes to show, like, this is the lunacy of the official state ideology of Canada taken to its logical conclusion, because based on the narratives that they've been pumping out, based on their ideology, Canada is a racist, white supremacist, settler colonialist country on stolen land and the genocide of the Indigenous. And well then why shouldn't they just be allowed to just take the country, and why shouldn't everything just be handed over to them? That's the logical conclusion of their ideology. And basically, it's just the lunacy of their worldview catching up with them. Now, I don't think it's actually going to result in a bunch of people's houses just being taken from them, even though it's in BC, and that would be mostly just Chinese, Indians, and libtards. So, I mean, it would be kind of funny if it happened to them. But I don't think that will happen. But it just shows, like, the lunacy of their worldview, and that, like, that's it being taken to the logical conclusion.
All right, that would be very funny to see these people losing the property that they've bought in their colonizing of the West. Would be very good. All right, well, I feel like we could talk and talk, but unfortunately, my next guest is due in 4 minutes, so
it's all right.
I'll have to end it there. Endeavor, this has been a very interesting and wide ranging conversation. So thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me on, Woz. It's always a lot of fun.
Yeah, I hope you've enjoyed it. And I hope the audience have enjoyed it as well, of course. All right, I'll be back in about 5 minutes with the next guest. But in the meantime, Endeavor, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year. All right, thanks for...
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? The Millennial NFT is a unique animated vector graphic available for just one lucky owner. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.